Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Quick, somebody ask the EPA what year it is, will you? Because why the starting point you pick really, really matters. Also, where the jobs are. Here's a hint, it might not be at job fairs. And we start a week of stories from our road shows, how we learn to stop worrying and love the numbers. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Monday, the 2nd of June. Great to have you here as always, gang. It is the 2nd of June, 2014, I should add, because to judge by the new rules on greenhouse gas emissions the EPA proposed today, you wouldn't really know. The White House wants to cut carbon dioxide emissions 30% by the year 2030. Not, as you might think, 30% from where we are today, though. Oh, no, it's 30% from where we were in 2005. Back when the economy was zipping right along and pollution was a lot higher. In point of fact, emissions have already dropped 15% since then, so we're basically halfway home. Marketplace's Dan Weissman has more now on what it looks like the rest of the way.
First, the last 9 years haven't exactly been an easy ride. Lucas Davis is an energy economist at Berkeley.
The biggest thing since 2005 has been the slow economic times since 2009, so that's not something to get excited about.
The recession meant lower demand for energy, especially from industries that use electricity to run factories. Doug Vine at the Center for Climate and Energy Solutions offers another contender for what's been driving emissions down.
The largest force is the natural gas boom that we've seen in this country.
Burning natural gas emits about half as much carbon dioxide as coal for the same amount of energy. However, up through 2005, gas prices were going up sharply, which ended up leading to further reductions. Here's Sue Tierney from the analysis group.
Those increases in natural gas prices were leading to increases in electricity prices, and that was making a lot of people very concerned.
And so a lot of states started promoting wind and solar power and energy efficiency. Dan Bacall from Cirrus points to one more factor pushing states forward, the 2009 federal stimulus.
Put a big slug of money into energy efficiency and renewable energy.
But the stimulus is over. The recession, too. Natural gas prices have started going back up, and coal's making a small comeback. Without a policy like the EPA's new regulations, analysts say we would expect to see greenhouse gas emissions start going up again. In Chicago, I'm Dan Weissman from Marketplace.
From the New York Times and Edward Snowden this past weekend, this somewhat unsettling revelation. The National Security Agency is collecting our faces, harvesting them, is what the Times says, collecting facial imagery to the tune of millions a day, and then using special recognition software to search for terrorists and other intelligence targets. Now, if you have ever used, I don't know, Facebook and seen how it has misidentified you as a tree trunk, perhaps, or a total stranger, you already know facial recognition software isn't perfect. Is the government, however, better at it than Facebook? Marketplace's Sabri Benishour has that story.
Facial recognition technology is not new.
The NSA and the CIA have quite openly been working with facial recognition technology now for at least the last 20 years.
Chris Green is technology analyst with Davies Murphy Group. He says private businesses have been pushing the technology forward, especially
in Las Vegas.
They use it to track down card counters and crooks.
Vegas has been a great proving ground for facial recognition technology. They were able to put a lot of money behind the technology and really refine and hone it down.
But these days, make no mistake, especially since 9/11, government funding is the main driver.
I would have to guess it's 70% or higher government dollars.
Chris Bainan is with Oak Ridge National Lab. But just how good is the technology now?
You could easily get the idea that modern technology is capable of taking all of Facebook's images and telling who you are. And that's very inaccurate.
He says Facebook uses tricks that make it seem super good at facial recognition. For example, it's not comparing faces to all of Facebook, it's just comparing them to their friend groups. In the real world, Patrick Grother tests commercially developed facial recognition technologies for the National Institute of Standards and Technology.
We enrolled 1.6 million individuals. We achieved 96% recognition rate.
So 96% of the time, they could pick out one guy out of 1.6 million guys. But that's only if they were using controlled photos like passports or driver's licenses. That's why you're not supposed to smile in those photos. It's useful if you're trying to pick out fraudulent passports, less so if you're trying to pick a bomber out of a crowded mall. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
The word of the day today on Wall Street was ISM. And yes, I know that's not actually a word. Still, we'll have the details when we do the numbers. Here's a little-known fact about this radio program. In all our 25 years on the air, there's only one segment that's been on each and every broadcast. It's that 45 seconds or so that comes after I say, but first, let's do the numbers. Numbers are obviously everywhere in business and economic journalism. You kind of can't get away from them, but you can get intimidated by them, or bored sometimes, dare I say. And it's not just stocks and bonds either. So after 25 years on the radio, we've put together a live show on stage and in person about the numbers we've come to know and love so well. We call it, in fact, How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Numbers. This week, we're going to air some of the stories from those shows, stories that cut through a bit of that numbers confusion.
You see them every day.
What is GDP?
Gosh, I don't know.
So inflation, what is it?
What does credit mean to you?
We premiered, if you will, 6 weeks ago in Washington, D.C. at WAMU. And one of our guests that night was Jim Bankoff, the CEO of Vox Media, a growing company in an industry where the numbers are distinctly against you. Welcome to the program. Really good to have you.
Thanks. Great to be here.
I'm going to go way out on a limb and guess that you are not interested especially in GDP or jobs or any of that stuff, and that the numbers that matter most to you come from ComScore, which tells you how many clicks and hits you're getting on your
site. ComScore is definitely one of the many metric sites we look at, for sure. ComScore reports monthly. We have metric services that report in real time, so we can literally look at a dashboard and just be obsessed with what's going on, who's looking at our content, how many people at any given moment.
Economists out there, if you had real-time data on the American economy, would your head explode? Yes? Right? Because your head would explode if you had that.
You can get sucked into that
stuff. Is there such a thing, then, as too many numbers? Can you have too much data?
Absolutely. We like to say, we tell our people, our journalists, our storytellers, that they should be data-informed as opposed to data-driven. So we want them to be cognizant of the numbers. We want them to know who's reading the site, how many people. But they can't make all their decisions based on that, because ultimately it's their job to both use their training, their instinct, their skills and talent, and then combine that with the numbers to come out with a great product.
How important, how interested are you in having people understand the metrics and the numbers by which you do your job?
We make money by growing our metrics, and those metrics are largely transparent, and we make a lot of them transparent. So, for instance, and you all use the web, you can go to your favorite website, and you can see how many people shared your favorite article on Facebook or on Twitter. Right. A lot of these metrics are now transparent, and we're making them more and more transparent. And of course, our ratings, in our case, our ComScore numbers, are transparent to our advertisers, too.
Right. So. Two things about that. Number one, hit us up on Twitter. And number two, related, how wound up should I be about the number of Twitter followers I have?
Well, I know that you have more than at Bankoff, so at least for now.
Let me look. Hold on. Where are we now? Okay.
No, you know, I think you're doing just fine, and I'm sure you'll be better after tonight.
Well, so you are widely seen, you, Vox Media, and some of the sites you run are widely seen as leading, as being on the cutting edge of the technology of digital journalism. When did you know that you had to figure out a way to manipulate those numbers and crunch the data that way?
Well, it's interesting. You know, we tend to think of all industries right now as being transformed by technology. Yeah. You cover this all: energy, education, healthcare. Well, media is being changed by technology, yeah, too. Yet, media seems to be one of the slower industries to react. And
say that again, man. Say that again.
Media tends,
yeah,
to be one.
Speaking into my microphone. Yeah.
And so we figured early on, well, all these other industries are being transformed. Why shouldn't media be transformed? And yes, the numbers bore it out. We were able to produce content more efficiently in a more targeted way. But for Vox Media, we, again, use technology to assist the storytelling and, mm-hmm, assist the consumption, not replace it, not supplant it.
Where do you go from here? Do you just keep growing with using the metrics that you have and using the numbers that you have and the methodology of data journalism?
We're happy with where we are. You know, last year in 2013, we were the fastest growing, yeah, media company in the Comscore 100, in the top 100 sites. We like our approach of technology-driven storytelling. And yes, you have to keep using the numbers. You have to inform the people who create the stuff. You have to inform the audience, keep creating great work, ultimately.
Jim Bankoff, Vox Media. Thanks very much. I really appreciate it. Thank you so much. You can't talk numbers and how to stop worrying and love them without talking about GDP, gross domestic product. We brought our Shanghai correspondent Rob Schmitz home for our road shows in Washington to tell the real story of China's decades-long, near-constant, double-digit GDP growth. Up to now, the growth model there has been building big government projects, highways and bullet trains and real estate. Big real estate projects they have built, in fact, by the dozens, entire cities that now sit, amazingly enough, empty. Here's Rob.
Nearly a year ago, I visited a replica of New York City under construction outside the northern Chinese city of Tianjin. Workers were constructing dozens of skyscrapers on land shaped like the island of Manhattan. They had plans for a Lincoln Center, a Rockefeller Center. Lin Lishui, a salesman for one of the developers, was beside himself.
Our goal is to create the world's largest financial center right here within 10 years. We're building skyscrapers. We've got China's largest high-speed railway station coming soon. We're building a tunnel under the sea, and we'll soon build several subway lines.
A year later, construction on this city named Yujiapu has grinded to a halt. Investors have pulled out. A cluster of skyscrapers sit half-finished. It's Manhattan on hold.
It was a failure before it even started.
Gao Fei is director of investment consulting at Centerline Property in Tianjin.
The most important thing for Tianjin's government has always been a high GDP rate. That means the government has to spend a lot of money on huge projects like this one. In China, these kinds of wasteful projects are everywhere.
For years, high GDP growth ensured local officials' promotions within the party. In the case of Yujiapu, the faltering Manhattan replica, it helped boost Tianjin's GDP growth rate to around 16% for 3 years, the fastest in China. And that helped former Tianjin Mayor Zhang Gaoli get promoted to Vice Premier of China. In Zhang's rearview mirror on his way to Beijing, a failed project and mountains of debt. Hundreds of miles away lies China's most infamous example of a colossal waste of money. The city of Kangbashi, where on most mornings you can watch staff members of the local hotel do a choreographed dance to techno music sprinkled with horse calls. There's really nothing else to do here. The city, built for a population the size of Pittsburgh, is nearly empty. It was built a decade ago to house around 500,000 people. At the time, the region, known as Ordos, was filthy rich from selling coal. But now, coal prices are low, and according to state media, Ordos is in so much debt it had to borrow tens of millions of dollars from a developer to pay its city employees. Xiongang came here to set up a restaurant to serve them.
Everyone knows this is a ghost town, so our restaurant doesn't have to pay rent for 3 years. The government gave it to us for free so that they had a place to eat. They also hoped more businesses would come.
Mission failed. The Ordos shopping mall next door is 5 floors of emptiness. Across an empty public square filled with giant bronze statues of Genghis Khan's family, I walk through the dark halls of an office building, dozens of doors for rent signs on all of them. I see a woman coming out of one of them. She says she works at a grocery store serving city employees. She came here from the countryside, and she pays the equivalent of $75 a month to sleep in an empty office space. She washes herself in the building's public bathroom down the hall. Dozens of other migrant workers live here too, all trying to make what they can off of what's left of this city. Ordos's government has now issued a ban on all construction, but before that goes into effect, the city can't seem to help itself. It's building a new skyscraper park and three sports stadiums costing hundreds of millions of dollars. Back in Tianjin, real estate analyst Gao Fei isn't optimistic about China's efforts to prevent future economic waste like Yujiapu and Ordos.
You can't do anything about it. Local officials are too powerful. They're only concerned with their five-year terms in office. If they can produce good numbers, they'll be promoted. They're not interested in the long-term plan.
Gao hopes for a day in China when government officials are evaluated for more than just local GDP growth. He says what really matters is the income of the people they govern, access to good health care and education. If these were the new goals in China, he says, all of this would be easy to solve. Reporting from Tianjin and Ordos, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
We've got some amazing pictures from Rob's story of those empty cities. You can see them on our website. While you're there, check out the dates for our other road shows as well. Also, a post by our Friday regular and Fortune magazine assistant managing editor Lee Gallagher on her favorite number. Here's a hint. It starts with Fortune 500, which came out today. It's marketplace.org, of course. Coming up, what do you get when you write a novel during a recession?
Two people who had always thought that their jobs would be very safe, and then to have that taken away from them and have to be forced to reinvent themselves a little bit.
But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 26 points today, a tenth of 1%, finished at 16,743. The NASDAQ off 5 points, about a tenth percent, closed at 4,237. The S&P 500 gained a point, yes, about one-tenth percent, closed at 19.24. Broadcom dialed up 9% today. The chipmaker wants to sell off or even shut down its cell phone chip business. Rival Qualcomm dialed up a half percent. Intel slipped two-tenths of 1% today. Apple soured two-thirds of 1% after announcing a new operating system, iOS 8, if you're keeping track, at its annual developers conference. No big toys, though. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note up to 2.52%. You're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Tuesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on factory orders for April. A Senate subcommittee on green jobs and the new economy discusses farming, fishing, forestry, and hunting in an era of changing climate. And read some poetry in honor of Allen Ginsberg. He was born on June 3rd, 1926. I'm Michelle Filippi.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. The May unemployment report will be upon us Friday morning, and I'm not going to hazard a guess as to either the rate or the number of new jobs in this economy, but I will offer this none-too-shocking preview. The numbers will show too many people are still out of work and have been for too long. One way to get people into new jobs in this post-Great Recession economy is the good old-fashioned job fair. You hear a lot about them, but not so much about what goes on inside them and whether anyone actually gets hired at them. So we sent Marketplace's Mark Garrison to a career fair in New York City for a little look-see.
Out on the sidewalk in front of a Midtown Holiday Inn, hundreds are lined up waiting to get inside the job fair in the hotel's ballroom. Those at the very front got here more than an hour before it even opens. Victor Jackson's been out of work a couple months.
Actually looking for a union job or something with good benefits. So I have a child I need to take care of and try to get back on my feet.
The guy from the company running the job fair gets word over a walkie-talkie. Let him in.
How you doing, sir? Walk in to the left, down the hall.
Inside the ballroom, several tables advertise government and nonprofit jobs. NYPD officers are here, armed with glossy posters and swag. So are many for-profit colleges angling for students. Most of the rest of the tables promise sales jobs, mainly for companies you've never heard of. Jackson heads straight for his first target.
Who are you online for right now?
Right now I'm waiting for the U.S. Postal Service.
He's not alone. The Postal Service has the longest lines in the room all day. Here's what job seekers hear.
All of our application process is online.
Over at the table for the nonprofit Boys Town, it's a similar experience. Over.
Take my brochure. That's our website.
And over.
Have a look at our website.
and over.
You go online, boystown.org, you can see the various positions we have.
At table after table, job hunters are told to do what they could have done at home in their pajamas, apply online. John Jelly is executive director of Boys Town, New York.
There's no actually interviews or anything today. It's more just getting that interest and driving people towards the application process.
This is a for-profit job fair where employers pay an organizer for the right to be here. A table starts around $1,200, depending on the package. They wouldn't pay it if they didn't believe coming here will get them new applicants they wouldn't find otherwise. More than 500 job seekers stream through today. But the reality is, at most job fairs, everybody goes home without a job.
It's still basically a crapshoot.
Adam Vega is unemployed and has been to enough job fairs to develop a thick skepticism. So why is he here?
You might not even get anything accomplished, but just the mere fact you got up and attempted it sort of pushes you away from that lazy side. So you can go to bed, you know, with a clear mind.
But many career consultants think job fairs are a waste of time.
The problem with job fairs is they're an en masse kind of activity.
John Challenger is CEO of Challenger Gray and Christmas, which specializes in finding jobs for laid-off workers.
The interaction between the employer and the potential recruit just isn't strong enough.
A while back, Challenger surveyed HR execs about what career search techniques are most effective. Guess where job fairs rank?
Dead last.
Even reading newspaper want ads is seen as more effective. At the top of the list is networking.
Career fairs are just that. They are networking.
Mike Brown doesn't agree with job fair critics. No surprise, since he owns Choice Career Fairs. In business more than a decade, he put on the New York event and produces dozens of them nationwide. He shows us the calendar in his Las Vegas office.
On June 12th, we have San Antonio and Albuquerque, along with Cleveland. The end of the month.
Back at the New York job fair, the recruiters agree, saying face-to-face contact is an edge for job hunters.
We have an interview slot open tomorrow at 11.
Christy Day with Aflac is lining up meetings later in the week with some promising candidates. She's seen career fair hires do well.
Our second highest performing agent came from a job fair, so we do have excellent success.
Several days later, she tells me they're close to hiring a couple people from this job fair. Those two probably don't feel like they wasted an afternoon. The unemployed have ample time, and the best way to use it is ultimately up to them. In New York, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
In keeping with our theme of the week, that is numbers, here's one. 78. That's how many weeks Gillian Flynn's book, Gone Girl, has been on the New York Times bestseller list. Success like that in publishing is about a whole lot of things. Sales, obviously, staying power, and also the business of words. So that's what we're asking authors to do for us this week. Share the numbers they think about when they write, how they infuse the economic world around them into their storytelling. Here's Gillian Flynn.
For me, particularly with Gone Girl, I started writing it at the height of the recession. I had lost my magazine job at that time and was looking at all these industries that were shutting down. And as I set about trying to figure out who my characters were, I realized that one of them definitely was a magazine guy who had been laid off. And I knew I wanted them, the two main characters, Nick and Amy, to return to their little bankrupt town, where everything else was also kind of shutting down. The town had been a destination place only because of this giant super mall. And I had been reading all these stories about the end of shopping malls at that time. And so I kind of had this idea, this image of this, the economy as represented by this giant, abandoned, almost haunted shopping mall in the middle of this dying little town. I wanted to explore what that meant to lose a job, what that meant to people of our age in their late 30s. You know, I had Nick and Amy laid off, two people who had always thought that their jobs would be very safe, and then to have that taken away from them and have to be forced to reinvent themselves a little bit, and what that meant to them and what that meant to their marriage. You know, for me, writing about the economic worry that Nick is going through in the book, that was taken straight from my own, you know, personal experience. I had studied journalism because, you know, when I was in school in the 90s, that was a very safe way to write for a living. And there was always going to be newspapers and there was always going to be magazines. And none of us really saw the internet revolution coming to the extent of how it was going to affect us personally. You know, so Nick discusses in the book, you know, what that means to him to have prided himself on having worked to get to where he was and assumed that he would be safe there. And you know, I certainly speak for myself when I was laid off and, you know, no one was hiring any sort of writers. There hadn't been no reinvention yet of what we would all do next. And I didn't have the next book contract. And, you know, I spent a lot of time thinking, you know, what else would I be good at? What do I do? So I translated, you know, a lot of those worries just straight onto Nick, and it really helped me find his character and the sort of panic and insecurity that he was working from.
Gillian Flynn about her book Gone Girl. Tell us what numbers rule your world, would you? You can tweet us at Marketplace. This final note today in which we present a number not to be loved. You know how economic indicators are often revised higher or lower, usually a month or so after they come out? Well, today's report from the Institute of Supply Management, the ISM for short, it measures how American factories are doing, was revised twice in the space of about 3 hours. Wall Street sold off hard on the initial weak but incorrect report. Software glitches, the ISM said. To which I say, caveat emptor, baby. That's the name of the game with numbers. All right, we're done. That is Marketplace from 8 p.m. on this Monday, I guess it is. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bonder, Tommy Andres, Millie Jefferson, and Daisy Palacios. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is 8 p.m.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.